This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. This one features Paul Staines, a.k.a. Guido Fawkes. Now, if you're a political obsessive like me, or even if you're slightly less obsessed, you'll have definitely been onto his website, orderorder.com. It is the number one political blogging site in the UK. It is number one for a number of reasons, mainly because of the gossip that's on there and the stories that appear there first, that as the interview shows, often end up in newspapers. So many of them are started there. It really is, as he says, the home of the Westminster soap opera. It started in 2004, and when it first started, there was mystique around it and around him. He protected his identity for a while. We talk about that in the interview when his cover was blown on Newsnight. We discuss everything that you would want to discuss with Paul. How does he get his stories? Does he ever not publish any? The morality of running effectively a gossip site, and very interestingly, the conundrum of being a modern parent. What if his children Google him and find out what he does? For those of you with a keen knowledge of Westminster insiderism, we talk about the red rag debacle, which involved Damian McBride and Derek Draper. That gets discussed here. And I suppose in a way, we cover, perhaps not explicitly, but Paul's journey to the sort of mainstream and a defence of that sort of blogging, an insight into it. An hour, as with all my guests really, is just not enough. There are so many things. You know, you get the sense with Paul that he sat on a vast mountain of stories. And he does give us one. Listen out for it. We talk about the value of the website and whether we'd ever consider selling it. There were talks to sell it to someone very important indeed. So do listen out for that. I mean, globally important, certainly at one point. So it was very good of him to give us that scoop. And listen out as well, crikey. If you subscribe to his newsletter, as I do, and he knows your email address, then he knows what stories you look at. So that is a warning for all of us. But it's brilliant. He's a fascinating person to sit down opposite and listen to. And he was great, you know. It didn't feel like anything was out of bounds, as with all my guests. And he gave us a real peek into that world. And the main thing, really, you take away from it is just how fun it all sounds. You can email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. You can follow Paul, his website at least, on Twitter, @GuidoFawkes. If you've never been on it before, you are in for quite a treat. And you can follow me on Twitter. Get lots of emails to the email address, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for them all. One question I do ask is where you listen. So far, only people in exotic locations are telling me where they listen. In a way, it's funnier when it is just sat on a bus in the pouring rain. So don't feel as if there only has to be the exotic locations. But Mike Cooper says he enjoys listening to the podcast while walking through the canyons around Los Alamos, New Mexico. And Lawrence Newman listens in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam. I mean, when you sat in Britain at a time of year like this and it's freezing cold, it feels like they're rubbing their noses in it a bit. I should try and get sponsored by Thompson Holidays or something like that. Other holiday companies are available. But yes, here we are. Paul Staines, a.k.a. Guido. Be prepared for an hour of fascinating insight. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for being here.
Paul, you're someone who has had more impact in the area in which you exist, probably than anyone else. You're arguably the most influential political blogger in the UK, and a blog site that is specific in tone. There's nothing else quite like it out there. There are opinion sites out there, but none of them do exactly what Guido Fawkes does. And I don't think any of them strike fear into the heart of politicians in the way that you do. What was it that made you want to set up the site, and what sort of site did you want to create?
I was involved in litigation. It was going for 2 years. I couldn't work. I was a city boy and I was suing my backer. Never do that, by the way, because your backer tends to be richer than you and you run out of money. But aside from that, so I couldn't work in the finance, so to speak. And I was posting to a site called Sam Is Data, which is run by a guy called Perry de Havilland. And it was in those days, blogging, this is like 2000-ish, it was all about the Gulf War, whichever Gulf War it was, I can't remember. And they would write these 3,000-word-long essays, and, you know, like a Telegraph leader. And then there'd be another left-wing blog that would do a 3,000-word Guardian leader-style thing. And I would send in, email in these kind of short, snappy pieces, a bit more like a traditional diary column, yeah, you know, pieces and little nugget-sized pieces. And Perry would pretend he'd lost it in his spam filter because it was drunken or didn't really make sense, or wasn't the kind of tone he wanted, the kind of broadsheet kind of tone he wanted. He said to me, why don't you do it yourself? And I went, oh, how do you do that? And he said, oh, try this blogger.com. It's free and Google. And so I went on that and I just did everything wrong and it all worked out right.
So was that, did you set it up originally as Guido Fawkes or did you set it up as something else?
Yeah, no, I set it up originally as Guido Fawkes. I think the URL was novemberthe5th.blogspot.com. And the graphics were done on Microsoft Paint. I chose the name Guido Fawkes because I thought, what's the most strong brand name you can think of that's anti-political?
Yeah.
And Guy Fawkes and Guido Fawkes. And I'd never heard of the Alan Moore books, which everyone else says, oh, did you get it from there? You know, and the Anonymous Mask. No, I'd never heard of them. And actually, later on, came into contact with Alan Moore and he said he's a fan. And he's quite a different politics to me.
I mean, you say you're anti-politics, but you'd been a member of the SDP and the Tory party. For a while, you'd been pro-politics.
Yeah, so I was, in a strange way. So I was very politically precocious, shall we say.
Yeah.
But I never thought the Tories were cool. And so I was always a bit uneasy about it. And I used to, I think when I was a teenager, I'd describe myself as an anarcho-capitalist, which sounded much cooler. And, you know, I think I settled down as a libertarian. And I'd say I'm a libertarian conservative now. But I'm very wary of politicians and political parties.
Equally?
No. I mean, it's no surprise to say that I prefer the blue team to be in power than the red team. But, you know, I'm never completely happy with any of them. And I don't think many people are.
No, I think that's true. I mean, I racked my brains about when I first encountered orderorder.com, when it was first on the scene.
When you were SPAD, weren't you?
I was working for the party.
Uh-huh.
And that was when it came about. So it must have been maybe 2007, around that sort of period.
Yeah, so we were just starting to get traction. I was just starting to get traction then. Yeah.
And it went around like wildfire. And what I do remember is people did try and set up rivals. There was one called Recess Monkey.
Oh, by Alex Hill, who was a friend of mine and a business partner of mine.
Yeah. So, but that why did yours prevail and his didn't?
Because he didn't work very hard. he is a very funny guy, and he is truly a friend of mine nowadays still. But he just didn't have the work ethic. And I believed that it could be made to pay off. And I looked at Matt Drudge crossing the Atlantic. And I thought, Matt Drudge is making a fortune. I can make this work. And I also was very highly motivated in the sense that I did think not only was the government pretty shabby, I thought the opposition was pretty shabby as well. So I was kind of politically motivated, you know, and it wasn't really all about the money that motivated me to do it. If I wanted to make money, I'd go back into finance.
So how do you make money off it? Just advertising, or is there another
way? Well, Alex Hilton came to me one day, as you mentioned him, on Recess Mate, and said, we've got all these people in Parliament and Whitehall reading this. They're quite important. Why don't we sell advertising? And we went, and he had the idea for this, and we went around to see all the other blogs, Conservative, Home, Labour, whatever, you know, and all of them, and said, look, why don't we get round and set up a cooperative and sell advertising? And we had all these meetings, and nobody really wanted to do the VAT return. They wanted to write their 3,000-word essays on their blogs.
Yeah.
And I said to Hilton, let's do it. And so we set up Message Space. And Alex, God bless him, I'm sure you won't mind me saying this, still didn't have a good enough work ethic in my view. And after a couple of years of us making like no money, I bought him out for he needed money and I bought him out. And now it's a little bit more lucrative. So we sell advertising to corporates who want to reach Westminster. Well, that's why we come on it. You'll see all these rubbishy Google ads that, you know, the same that you see everywhere else. But then you'll see ads from Heathrow or
yes.
from the defence companies or contractors. And the people who they're going to, I mean, say there's 100,000 reasons coming a day, they want to reach 5,000 of them who actually run the country.
They're big clients. This isn't tin pot advertising.
No, it's blue chip government contractors.
So how many, when you first set it up to now, how many? How do you measure it? Individual clicks, individual visits a day?
Say 2005, it was about 60 a day, and 50 of those were me pressing F5 to see if anyone left a comment. And then I'd say by about 2007, you reading it, it was probably a few thousand a day. You know?
Yeah.
And I can remember someone saying to me, oh, you can never get more than 10,000 readers in the UK, you don't understand. Well, we have 10,000 hits by breakfast. You know?
Wow.
So if we don't do 100,000 a day, I would be very annoyed with the team, to say the least. And, you know, so I think we're floating around 150,000 on a dull day. If there's news flow, it's very dependent on news flow. If there's action, a reshuffle, or somebody's in a ship for something, you know, it can go up to a third of a million a day.
Wow.
Yeah. So I had to pay for a lot more powerful servers.
In terms of the influence that it has, you've had, I suppose, that they live in fear of you, even Conservatives, because you do a fair bit of Tory bashing on there, even if you are.
Well, we keep records, and we have caused more Tory politicians to resign than Labour politicians.
Do you know the numbers off the top of your head?
I think one year we did three MPs.
Wow.
What was it? Roughly Yeo and Brooks Newmark, all in the same year.
Oh, of course, Brooks Newmark was the Paisley Pyjamas. Yes. But you had not so much allies, admirers in very senior... But I mean, David Cameron was a fan of yours.
Yes, he was a daily reader. And Spads would come and say to me that they had been in the meeting and said, I've got this idea, why don't we do this? And I've heard this. And he would say, yes, I saw that on Guido last night. And he would do a thing on a Tuesday where he would get in the chief whip and they would talk about PMQs and he'd flick through Guido and say, let's do that. And I would get a phone call from a special advisor. I'm giving the game away here a bit. Special advisor saying, we just want to check out some more details on this. Have you got anything on this? And I would say, well, what are you doing? He said, oh, David's thinking of doing something with that tomorrow. So then we would... be basically writing the PMQ's attack lines.
Wow.
It was good fun. He was, and the game for them was, and Osborne, I suppose, was much more like that. It was like Theresa May and Corbyn aren't really in that kind of point-scoring, debating society kind of game, are they?
They're not. Would he ever ring you directly and thank you?
No.
So there was never any personal contact?
No. I never deal with the principals like that because I don't like it, and there's not really anything in it. I don't need to do interviews, right?
Yeah.
So I don't need to have a personal relationship with them.
But is that a way of you keeping yourself pure in a way that you don't want to feel compromised? You don't want to make friends with people that you might have to do a story on?
Yeah, I often say, you know, I didn't go into Westminster to make friends, and I've succeeded in that objective for sure. And I think there's a couple of politicians who I would socialise, I'd have socialised with in the past, and I enjoy the company. But, you know, then they're caught in bed, and it's really awkward. Nigel, did you really do it five times a night with this Latvian air hostess? Oh, go away! You know, it's not really... It doesn't really help that if you're from Friendly Turns them.
No. I mean, at first, you tried to keep your identity secret. Was that part of building the brand?
Well, I had been in politics, and I was a very junior bag carrier, and I was working in political campaigns and think tanks in my early 20s. And I didn't want the baggage from that period to be associated with the decade later me that was doing Guido Fawkes. In retrospect, that was a pretty stupid idea because you don't have any authority when you're anonymous. And I think there's a role for people who are in hostile regimes, you know, in Iran or Russia being anonymous, or China. And, you know, or if you're a whistleblower in the police service or civil service, they can be anonymous. But if you're going to knock down politicians, you ought to be able to stand up and you, for yourself. So I think that was a mistake.
Did you fear, because there's the infamous appearance on Newsnight where it's Paxman hosting it and Michael White, and you appear silhouetted like someone who's, you know, somebody who was at the time protecting their identity, and Michael White blows your cover.
Robbie Gibb was the producer for that Newsnight.
Oh, right, OK.
And I knew him from student politics. I think I can say that now he's actually in a political position and not the token Tory at the BBC. And he tried to get me to go on Newsnight loads of times, and he got me to do a video saying what a crap system the lobby system was. And he flattered me and said, oh, it's great. Well, why don't you do a two-way with, we'll get Michael White on, you and him are always at it, aren't you? And Paxman will referee. And I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. Okay, why don't we do you like a super grass criminal, and we'll put a mask, you can wear a gear. So he kept on, and I fell for it. And, you know, I was going to Paxman was going to referee. First thing Paxman said was, have a go at me. And I was like, oh, God, why did I go to this? So everyone enjoyed it. I think it was the first time I'd fallen flat on my face, and it was much, much enjoyed by the lobby.
But did you worry at that point that you'd compromised the brand or that the game was up?
I thought it was a mistake. Camilla, who does Pop Bitch, Camilla Wright, who does Pop Bitch, and me and her are old friends, and she told me in the beginning that you don't want to do publicity because you can never morally justify gossip. It's always, and you don't want to go on TV. Anyway, a month or so later, I saw her on some panel on TV, and I thought, what the hell is that all about? But on the whole, I think foolish faces public places. And if you put yourself, I don't want to be on Question Time and all those kind of things. It's
just, have you been approached?
Yeah, and I'd find it a bit daunting. I'd answered any questions.
Yeah,
and got my Dimblebees muddled up, and that went bad.
Sounds like a euphemism.
It's just, you know. So I found that quite daunting, and just look, I don't have a book to sell, or you know, I'm not canvassing for votes, so I don't need to do any of that stuff.
You must get so many stories from people. Must willingly now submit you stuff.
Yeah,
want
so
you to
it's
publish.
Always been the case that we've always made ourselves. I've always made myself open. You know, I still have a fax number. If people don't know what a fax number is, Google it. Always had the email address up there, and I think a lot of people. And also, there's used to be a bit more of a soap opera. You know, I'd report back from going to parties and drunken escapades, and the character and me were kind of interchangeable, so people felt they knew me. Also famous for Westminster, people felt they knew me, and they would call up and email in, which I don't think, you know, if you wanted to tell someone to private eye and you're a junior researcher, who do you call, how do you get to them, you know? It's with me, I think they've seen me around in the pub, so they know.
So what's your decision process on what to upload and what not to?
There's very little we won't upload, I think.
That's reassuring. That's good to know.
Is it true? Is the first decision. I mean, bear in mind, I'm told that people are gay, having an affair, cheating, Lotharios. That's the same person I'm talking about, you know. So most people have five sex lives, according to some of the sources we have. After a while, you get an idea of what's likely to be true, you know. If it's a sort of pants-down story, I have a general idea at this time who all the shaggers are.
Yeah.
You know, it's just proving it and or disproving it. So those kind of stories are more difficult. Quite a lot of them, I have to be honest, don't appear on the website first. They might appear in a Sunday newspaper beforehand. Because what I learned very early on was after I broke a few of those stories on the website that all the newspapers then run it the next day.
Yeah.
And ring me up and say, you could have got some money for that. So stop doing it. So quite often now we'll do it with the newspaper.
So this is the Sun on Sunday that you've got?
Or the Sun on Sunday. You know, I have a very open-minded relationship with most of Fleet Street.
Yeah.
And we'll do it with, you know, the highest bidder.
Is that a sign that you're, in a way, becoming more legit?
No, it's a sign that you know, I have an expensive lifestyle. and if I can make £10,000 for calling up Simon Walters at the Mail on Sunday, I will do. You know, it's quite simple.
So in a way, do you behave like a traditional political journalist, that someone will bring you a story and then you try and stand it up? You'll contact the person that the story's
yes.
about?
Yes, so we'll try and stand it up. Quite often if it's... the easy ones are photo stories. So someone will come in... The age of mobile phones. The Seamus Milne story, for instance, of him having a very close conversation with... I've forgotten her name. Jennifer Robinson. The
lawyer, was
Assange's
it?
Lawyer, that's right. Blonde. Very out of the usual mistress typecasting. That photo was a drunken reader of the blog in the bar saying, "That's Seamus Milne." And I mean, the more photos we had, you could tell he was hammered when he took the photos.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of, and him trying to be discreet about it, like put his hand in front of it so you could. But that is easy. So we just call up, you know, a contact, and the photos are sold, and great business. And, you know, kits out the wine cellar.
Do you ever have, victims isn't the right word, the subjects of these stories get in touch with you and say, "You've ruined my marriage," or "You've ruined my career"?
In the heat of it, they don't say that. In the heat of it, they usually lie and say, "It isn't me, I didn't do it." But years later, I will bump into them. And I can never be a politician, I've got a terrible memory for faces and names. Yes. And they'll say, "You don't remember me, do you?" Or they'll say, "Do you remember me?" And I'll go, "No." And they'll explain how I ruined their life. And, you know, they quite often have done wrong. I mean, a year after Brooks Newmark, for instance, I found myself on a panel in Annabelle's for some reason, talking about politics. And we never mentioned it. And we went to dinner afterwards, and it's like eight of us after the panel discussion. And he never mentioned the fact that, you know, we'd knocked out his career and forced him to resign.
But that had not featured in the panel discussion, or it had, and he chose not to ignore it.
No, it was all very awkward. Apparently the person organised it didn't realise, and they knew them from, you know, Foreign Affairs, Brooks from Foreign Affairs, and his wife says to him, "You can't have those two." And he apparently called me and said, "If you want to pull out, that's fine." And I said, "I'm not bothered, but he's not bothered." And he said the same. So you're just perfectly civil.
And not awkward at all? There was no hint?
Well, as soon as you had a few drinks, I'm fine, you know. I don't know about him.
Do you have to be careful if you're going into Parliament or, you know, around the Red Lion or the St Stephen's Tavern or any of the areas around? Do you have to be careful that you put yourself slightly...
You know, I haven't had any pints thrown over me for quite a while. I was a bit worried about going to Liverpool for Labour conference.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that might be a little bit more fruity. So whenever there was trouble, I'd just point out to my mate, "He works for The Sun," and wander off.
So when was the last time you had a pint thrown over you?
I think that was probably more than 5 years ago.
Do you take that as a sort of badge of honour, or is it intimidating when it happens?
I just think it goes with the territory, you know. If you dish it out, people go... It's usually someone junior who'll do it, you know. It's not... Stella Creasy has a very odd relationship with me. She's always very testy with me and on the verge of, looks like for me, lunging at me and grabbing my throat, but she hasn't done it so far.
Okay, well, that's good. Do you ever get any threats yourself? Do people ever try and take revenge?
A death threat, not more than one a week, I'd say. Usually, you know, the people who threaten you via email, I think, aren't going to do it.
Yeah.
Only once had, and this is when I still lived in London, or my family lived in London, and we had one guy with a machete turned up on the doorstep. It's kind of...
Oh, God.
So I did call the police that time, and he was pretty much thrown up against the wall, and, you know, he was dealt with quite severely.
And was that someone that you knew, or was that just a reader of the blog, or what?
I'm not quite sure.
My word, that's scary.
That's the only time someone's physically... I'm very careful about where I live. And if you're listening, would-be assassin, I live in Ireland. and I just come over to London Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. But that's the only time. That's the only time I've called the police. I just don't worry about it.
But it didn't make you think, maybe I should stop doing this?
No. My wife is very, very, very uncomfortable about that whole thing. She's like, "Don't bring it back on your doorstep." Which is a bit awkward when I left next door to Emily Thornberry.
What are the concerns your wife has? Just the repercussions or just the nature of the work anyway?
She thinks, for some reason, I don't know why, she thinks that I bring on the trouble upon myself unnecessarily. I remember when... probably one of the best stories we ever did was Smeargate, Damon McBride. And
absolutely.
All that. She was picking me up in the car and sort of like, children were quite young and there were sort of nappies flying around and we were going off to Asda to bulk buy more nappies probably. And she had, the penny had dropped what was going on. And she was like, these are powerful people. They run Downing Street. Why are we doing this? And I was like, well, this is kind of what I do, you know, and I was really enjoying it. She's like, this could cause us a lot of trouble. Anyway, so she's got a normal motherly defensive attitude and she's always worried that I'm going to run towards the sound of gunfire.
there's a lot of moral hypocrisy around websites and gossip or however...
Nobody's perfect.
However you would call it, absolutely. And the popularity of the site proves that whilst people may have issues with some of the stuff that's on there, everyone enjoys reading it. Do you ever think, oh, God, maybe I've gone too far? Or, you know, the gossip in itself is not immoral, but perhaps morally challenging way to make a living?
It's bloody lucrative, though. as I said at the very beginning of this conversation, Camilla of Popbit said, never try to morally justify it. I think there are, if I am going to get my high horse, and when I write for the broadsheets occasion, I will explain it in this way. I think a politician who lies to his wife will lie to the voters more readily. And that is my experience. And I think that normal people understand it, which is why politicians don't like to be caught, you know, being adulterous.
It's an important part of a functioning democracy to have websites like yours that can expose hypocrisy and wrongdoing.
As Boris said at our 10-year anniversary party, we're the dung heap that fertilises... I can't even remember what he said. The rose bed of democracy or something.
I saw the clip of him there. I mean, is he someone that you talk about people with reputations and private lives? You must get offered a lot of stories about Boris.
I think I know most of them. Including the ones we're injuncted to mention. Can we even mention the injunction? I can't even remember. I think 2/3 of them are true in Boris's case. Yeah. You know, it's going to be fun, isn't it?
The red rag experience was explosive for a number of reasons. Firstly, it appeared to go to the heart of Downing Street. Secondly, it was born of a desire, apparently, on behalf of Damien McBride and Derek Draper and those that were involved, to set up a left-wing rival to Guido. Before we get into the specifics of what happened with Red Rag, do you think it is easier to do sites like this from the right?
I don't know, because I've never tried to do it from the left, but I remember when the Tories were in opposition, people saying, oh, it's easy for you, you're insurgent, you're in opposition. And now they say, oh, it's easy for you, the Tories are in government. So it's not easy. I mean, there are left-wing sites that try and do it. I think there's a new one, the latest in a long line of them, Red Raw.
Yes, I've seen that.
Yes, it's called a Blairite version of Guido, isn't it?
So, it doesn't feel quite right somehow. You know, it feels almost as if, and not, I don't
take a corporate designer's been charged to do it, you know. I imagine Tony Blair plotting, yes, we need our version of one of these. Get me a PR man and get me a corporate graphic designer in, you know, and they're trying to do it. It feels like there's a committee of you Blairites sending in articles after you do it.
In a way, on websites like Squawkbox and The Canary, even though they're very different, aren't
they? Squawkbox, I think, has energy. It reminds me of the sort of raw anger that, you know, perhaps motivated Guido earlier in its career. You know, he's clearly angry about things and it comes through. He's just got a lack of editorial judgment, you know. So that's his problem.
Is that something that you think he could learn, though, and improve?
I think the difference between... the reason people left the centre read Guido is because they know we'll go after the story more than we'll try and politically sign it. Obviously, our worldview is, you know, low taxes and freedom are good, and high taxes and socialism is bad, but it doesn't get us in the way of the story of taking the piss out of Matt Hancock. Whereas I think there is something lacking on those those sites, but they just don't do that.
I wonder if, and this is purely a devil's advocate, purely for the indulgence of considering it, are people on the right, or maybe in the and in the libertarian sphere, less likely to worry about offending people?
Oh, for
perhaps,
sure. Oh, for sure.
You know,
I mean,
comfortable liberal.
I mean,
types.
I don't. I'm not a kind of PC gone mad Richard Littledon type, but I do not understand all the identity politics stuff at all. And every now and then, my younger colleagues will say, "You can't say that." What do you mean you can't say that? Everyone goes there, don't they? So I read today that a Labour MP is having to go to a race and awareness, racial awareness course for describing his idea of going to a Chinese restaurant.
Oh, this is the Scottish Labour MP.
Yeah, now I'm not even going to go there, but I didn't realise that was such a bad word that you can't say it. So
when you, just in terms of what you talk about your colleagues, how many people are employed in the Guido world?
So, Alex Wickham's worked with me for about 5 years, and he is the news editor, and he probably writes most of the site, and he's a very good journalist, much more serious type than me. I worry that he wants to go write for the Telegraph or the Times or something.
Well, he already does some bits for the Spectator.
Oh, he does.
That,
he does. He does do highbrow stuff, and anyway, doesn't pay that well, but he does it. You know, likes to keep his arm in. And Ross Kensel, who is the most overeducated of us, double English, we call him because he got double English first from Cambridge, and he came in on an interesting route. He wrote to me and said, as a lot of people do, I'd like to. Really interested in politics, and he was working for one of those showbiz sort of agencies that does all those kind of David Beckham stories and, you know, footballers' wives and stuff like that. And he'd done that for a year or two, and he said, "I really want to do politics." And what I do with those kind of people is I give them a phone interview, and got on the phone, and I said, "Okay, so you've got a passion for politics," as they all say. I said, "Who's the Shadow Home Secretary?" He went, okay, let's do it a bit easier. Who's the Home Secretary? So your passion for politics doesn't go to knowing their names, does it? So he says, "No." I said, "Well, you know, come back with a story." A year later, he is the guy who recorded Paul Mason telling that
in
Spanish
the cafe.
Guy. Yeah, he'd gone up on his own spec with the kit that he usually uses to tape footballers' wives. And just by luck, and truly just by luck, I mean, I know Paul Mason thinks it's some kind of conspiracy from the Sun, but he was just by luck in that restaurant trying to get into the Momentum rally, but he couldn't get in, so he went there for lunch and saw Paul Mason in the corner and put his iPhone on and recorded it. And then he called me up after that splash in the Sun and said, "Now what?" I said, "You better come down."
And the Paul Mason story was him describing, was it the removal of
Corbyn?
Corbyn
has no... traction with the white working class or
that's
something,
right,
isn't it?
Right.
You know, and the next guy we've got to look at is Clive Lewis. He's the coming man. So that the reason that enrages Paul Mason so much is because it put him in the bad book. But at a time, if you remember, Paul Mason and Owen Jones had lost faith in Corbyn, hadn't they?
Well, there was certainly a change of opinion around that time that then changed back. But that's absolutely right. And I remember the story.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In terms of how you've been portrayed in terms of your politics, libertarianism isn't something that really fits onto the political scale in the minds of a lot of British people, they
think. I think it just means, in my case, likes to do drugs and low taxes.
Because you're involved in the Acid House movement.
Yeah, the reason that I featured all those, you know, 10 years, the Channel 4 kind of look back on 10 years of Acid House or 25 years of Acid House, I think we must be getting up to 35 years. Yeah. The reason I appear in all those is, one, I like to annoy everyone because that fascist bastard right wing, why is he on the idiot? And also, the reason that all the researchers called me up is because I wrote it up. And, you know, I just wrote up a few sort of essays, if you like, about the whole scene. And that's why I feature in the history of it a lot more than other people, you know.
But you were involved as a promoter at the time.
Yeah. So the biggest one, I think, was Sunrise, which my friend Tony Colson-Hayter ran. And when he was getting in all the trouble with the tabloids, the only person he knew anything about politics and dealing with the press was me. So he called me in, and I sort of fell out of... I was doing a lot of foreign affairs kind of campaigning and lobbying. Fell out of that and more into Acid House.
In terms of libertarianism, it's something that often UKIP types will use as a badge. Do you think they've given that sort of politics a bad name?
Well, originally, Nigel described himself as a libertarian, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he was. And I think only it changed when they decided to marry the issue. They realised that if they married immigration to Europe, it was a winning formula, a populist formula. Mm. I can remember Nigel being much more free market liberal on things than he was, say, 5-10 years ago.
Because when people have described you as a fascist and far right, does that offend you?
Yeah, I think it's ridiculous. You know, the caricature of me is, you know, a lot of... Well, it just doesn't make sense. Anyone who knows me knows I'm not like that, you know. And I sometimes, unfortunately, I do play up to it sometimes. You know, Pinochet had nice uniform kind of thing. And a lot of throwaway lines I've said to be funny, which I'll probably have done something in the last half hour, come back to haunt me immensely. You know, or sometimes I read all these tweets that come in when I've got... I'm not logged in. And, you know, the things I've done when I was 19 are amazing. You know, gun running for the Contras and whatnot. It's just a little bit over the top.
In terms of where politics is now and your influence in it, how close do you feel to, for want of a better phrase, the alt-right and Breitbart and things like that? Because in tone, there are similarities between what Guido's done and what Breitbart's done, if not perhaps the political direction. There's a punk element to it.
You don't... So Milo, I knew when he was a high Tory Catholic.
Yeah.
You know, and he was kind of that. Raheem, I've known him since he was a teenager, Raheem Kassam. I can remember when he was a liberal conservative. You know, so everyone moved around over there. I think the Breitbart dead end for politics. I mean, they're just trading on the anger over issues. I would say we're not there. We don't actually ever write about immigration. You know, we stay away from those kind of... I said to you, I don't even do identity politics because I think it gives the wrong vibe out.
Is that the wrong vibe in what regard, that it's toxic?
Yeah, I think it's pretty unpleasant, you know. And we have an ongoing war with our own comments. You know, if you venture into the badlands that are comments on any busy right of centre blog, or website rather, you know, from the Daily Mail to the Telegraph. I think the Telegraph got rid of them now, haven't they?
I think they have, yeah. Their website's very different now.
So we have algorithms that check for words. So I've learned 5,000 different words for Muslim, you know, the slang I've never even heard of.
But you have to program that yourself.
Yes, we over the years, we have a very long list of words you can't use. And then they'll switch to Cyrillic script or something, and, you know, so it's got harder and harder. So we basically ban a lot of people. And there's a whole website of people who've been banned by us saying how rubbish we are. And it's not Breitbart, but it's like...
how hard is it to moderate comments on the website? If you're going to allow comments...
You'll have to ask Ross, because it's always the newest guys in. I haven't moderated comments for years, but it's kind of... It's an alternative reality, you know, where... It's a nightmare.
There's an irony, isn't there, that you're making, you know, your website that for many people pushes the boundaries of free speech. Is there a limit to it in your world as well?
I'm interested in this because I'm kind of intrigued that you think that we sound like Breitbart, because I think we don't.
Well, I meant more in the sense of the attitude, that there's a punk element to it, that it doesn't behave in the way that the traditional right does, that there's a rebellious nature to it.
Yeah, I mean, yes, there's a rebellious nature to both sides, but they think there's a conspiracy against everyone on immigration and stuff like that, and I don't buy into that.
No.
You know, so the only time I think we've done a policy type view on immigration was backing Boris's amnesty for undocumented in London.
Do you feel that sometimes, maybe, I mean, you know, your views on politics are clear, but that you should perhaps polish your liberal views a bit more and appeal to, you know, if you're sort of more moderate on immigration.
I think I should just be myself.
Yeah.
But we don't tend to preach about policy too much. You know, as a general, might argue, we like covering things from think tanks and, you know, saying, ah, have you seen this? And
yeah,
this proves that, and arguing about Brexit impact assessments. But we don't generally, we're not the Fabians, you know, we don't tell you should think this.
There's a slight irony that, and you're absolutely right to want to expose hypocrisy and things like that, and in a way slightly anti-politics, but you must absolutely love it as well. Like, it gives you so much fun.
I think I love it less than I used to enjoy the chase, and I'm not so front line now. So
is that because of effectively becoming exhausted by it and jaded, or is it because of the way that politics has gone?
So I left politics in my 20s because I thought John Major was boring and rubbish. I'm slightly less interested in politics right now because possibly I think Theresa May is boring and rubbish. And also, you know, the goals of my political goals when I was 20 years old were end of Soviet communism, bring down the wall, end of socialism, a threat to British society, and getting us out of Europe. Well, the socialism's obviously come back as a threat, which I didn't realise, but 2 out of 3 is not bad. Maybe I was 50 last year, maybe I should retire. No.
But there must be within you somewhere a sort of respect for it and love of it.
I had lunch with someone today who's a disaffected Blairite, and
there's a few around.
Yeah, we can't get out of it. We want it's in your blood. You are infected. You know, it's a chess game with people, isn't it?
Yeah. And,
but that's what a lot of normal civilians think about it, that we're all just playing a game.
Well, I think as long as you've got a sense of how the world should be, or that you have a sense of guiding principles, I think it's okay to enjoy the game.
That's what people worry about, that we enjoy the game.
Oh, but it's thrilling, isn't it, to watch it? I mean, I want politicians of good moral standing, competence above all. But the thrills and spills, you know, the jealousy and the acrimony is part of what makes it so thrilling, part of what makes life so thrilling. I mean, politics is just an extension of humanity in that regard.
Yeah, I think the truth is I am a little bit bored of it at the moment. and I'm bored with Brexit a little bit. And, you know, I want the Tories to just get on and change leader. And, you know, let's start all-out war on Corbyn and get on with it. It's kind of, we're in a kind of very... Every day's Groundhog Day in politics at the moment.
Do politicians ever approach you for consultancy or advice? Have any politicians ever said, come and work for me, Paul? Be my press guy?
No. No, that's
never surprised.
Happened. Never happened. People do ask me to help them out with political problems sometimes, but I'm not a lobbyist, you know, and kind of... I have when somebody's... I have been able to point out to ministers and stuff that this and that, and feel I've done some good sometimes. And, you know, that's not anything that's good published, but it's not really what I'm about, and I'm not going to start pretending I am.
No. The red rag that we alluded to earlier was a fascinating episode where it was born out of a desire, really, from Labour circles to have something to rival yours. How did you find out about it?
So you want me to tell you the thing that everyone's asked me for years?
Yes!
Cough my sources.
Oh, it was worth a try.
And explain whether or not it was as everyone suspects. Well, I've just decided to do that. No, I'm not going to tell you. But obviously, it was they brought it on themselves, let's put it that way. I mean, Damien McBride and Derek Draper really brought it on themselves. They were the... I think they've worked out how it all happened, and they know.
So, just to go back over it, they were working in Downing Street.
Damien was the Gordon's press guy.
Derek Draper was running Labour list, but he was also involved in the Brown operation somewhere.
Yeah, so he was trying to ingratiate himself back in as usual, wasn't he? And he had taken on Labour list, which is a website that was to be the opposite of Conservative Home, you know, a sort of party aligned site that was going to be a community and discuss issues. Because they saw that, bizarrely, the right was doing better online and they wanted to emulate all that.
And they cracked a plan for a website called Red Rag.
They emailed themselves back and forth ideas for stories, and Damien was writing, the Prime Minister's press secretary was writing smear stories. And he accused Ian Dale. Now, if you know Ian, he's quite middle of the road.
He's a very gentle soul.
And accused him, I think, of being racist. Then accused me of being racist. And somebody knew it was a stitch-up. And
but did the website ever go live?
No.
So this was all.
That's why I was
brewing.
Sat on it from February till April, because I was waiting for it to go live, and then it'd be much better in my view if it had gone live. And I'd say, actually, this is a government operation, and it's a government black ops operation.
Yeah.
Instead, I had to do an email story.
So they'd knocked around a few ideas. Were all of the stories they had completely factually incorrect?
No, not in my view.
So they had some that actually were...
I don't know whether Cameron does have genital warts, but I had heard the story, the story's about Nadine Dorries. Well, she sued. In fact, I know she sued because I delivered the writ to Damien McBride.
Wow.
And she got that one. You know, they were stories that people had heard and couldn't stand up, and they thought that if they had this kind of anonymous site, they could get them out there.
And effectively get their own back on.
Yeah, I don't think it made any sense, to be honest. It was, they were the government. I think it was born of anger. And the anger was that Guido legitimised the story such that the normal Tory press could then follow it up and it would get momentum, and they wanted to do the same on the other side.
But obviously someone close to them...
Yeah, so I think someone felt that it was unfair to call Ian Dale a racist and me a racist.
Yeah.
And said, do you know this? And
I
went, no. And they showed me some of the emails, and I went, could I see any more? And that's where it went from.
I mean, when you first see something like that, does any part of you worry? Do you think, oh, my God, you know, actually, if people close to Downing Street are going to be involved in something like this and publish something that's going to call me a racist, that this could end my career or worse?
I mean, I'm lucky. You can't get sacked, can I?
No, but they could have waged war on you, perhaps. I mean, might have catastrophized.
They did wage war. You know, they went to town. Damien, people around Gordon. They tried to get the New Statesman to run stories. You know, they really were trying to take me out. I mean, I was convinced that, you know, my taxes were going to get investigated, and I was going to have trouble. You know, I had weird things that would make me sound like a conspiracy theorist happen. You know, they really did do everything they could.
So what sort of stuff did you get investigated and things like that?
No. I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist.
No.
But I did feel that a little bit under pressure. Yeah.
Crikey.
And don't forget, at this time, Damien Green just had his doors kicked in.
That's right, arrested in Parliament.
You know, that's what my wife was worried about. If they would do that to an MP, what would they do to you?
It was in the broad sweep of history, a lot of the details have been forgotten because politics has moved so fast since then. Certainly you were no fan of Gordon Brown and you would mercilessly mock him on the website. Was that, I can't remember the exact chronology, was that partly in revenge at the way you'd been treated, or was that...
I think it was because we went for him so ruthlessly and consistently. I mean, and did things that the normal press wouldn't do. And it became... So I'll give an example of something that normal TV wouldn't do, even Channel 4 wouldn't do. Gordon Brown picking his nose. Now, you might think this is a ridiculous little funny thing, right?
Yeah.
But Gordon Brown absentmindedly, before the budget, sat on the front bench, starts picking his nose.
Yeah.
Sticks his finger right up his nose, picks his nose three times, and kind of eats on a bit and wipes it on the back of his tie.
I remember it, yeah.
Well, you didn't. You weren't going to see that on the BBC, were you? And we got the video. And this is before things went viral. 500,000 people watched it. Right. So it ends up on Have I Got News For You and stuff like that. So we were making things happen that were kind of pushing what I think what the left has done to the right for years was being done back to them. They just didn't like it.
Did you ever feel, you know, you would paint him off as a clown and things like that? Did you ever feel that, in effectively question his mental health, that perhaps that was too far?
I don't think... I still do question his mental health. I mean, and I think we all know, anyone who's been around knows that he has not been in a good place. And the books have come out, you know, and it turned out all the stuff about the TBGBs and him ranting and raging and throwing phones all turned out to be true. Andrew Marr asked him the same question, didn't he? So, you know, I wasn't the only one who'd heard those stories.
When you think about how far the website's come and how influential it is and how it's made you into such a big figure, what do you think your greatest achievement is?
I am proud of all the young journalists who've worked for me and seeing them go on. You know, some of them probably don't want people to know that they worked for me. but, I mean, people who are happy to say, you know, Harry Cole is the Westminster correspondent and will go on to great things and will probably follow the Boris Johnson career path in the
future
end.
Foreign secretary.
Yeah, no doubt. Because he can't add up, so he'll have to be foreign secretary. Juliet Samuels, who's now the Telegraph's leading columnist, she worked for me for 2 years. So I kind of get some joy about that. And that I've germinated some, you know, staunch writer centre journalists. And, you know, Christian May didn't work for me, but was, you know, he's the editor of the City AM. I mean, these are all people I've known since they were quite in their teens.
What's the future of the site? I mean, you were very much ahead of your time. What are the threats to
I'm going to stick to my knitting. I did entertain the idea of going to India and doing the whole thing again in India. And I spent a lot of time on that. And
why India? People.
Well, I speak the language.
Yeah.
Indian politics is a very fascinating juncture. You know, the country is a coming superpower. If I could get a penny off every Indian, I'd be a very happy man. Yeah. And also, it's got a whole load of corruption problems. I think it would work. My wife doesn't want to go, though, so I can't do it. I think that might turn out to be my biggest regret, not going.
Have you looked at other countries, why not America?
Everyone says that to me. And I don't need to go to America because it's well served by everybody else. You know, I will give you a scoop if you want.
Oh, I'd love a scoop.
Steve Bannon. So after Trump got into the White House, Harry Cole called me and said, do you remember Steve Bannon? I said, that Steve Bannon, are you? Do you remember the American who tried to buy us? What? That same guy. Because I remembered him as sort of an investment banking guy. So before Breitbart was set up over here, I think it was Raheem called me up and said, I want to buy Guido off you. Really? I'll give you $100,000. Why would I do that? I took more out of it last year than that. If I would. About a week later, he calls me and said, I'll give you £250,000 for it. I was like, he sounds like he might actually have the money. So I said, well, can I speak to the organ grinder rather than the monkey? So he goes, okay, I'll arrange it. And this kind of, you know, sounded to me like an American investment banker type starts talking to me. You know. So I think we got up to $5 million I asked him for. Yeah, it was real money. And he said he'd think about it. And I know subsequently I heard, you know, from people who worked there, that they thought about it. He thought his immediate response was, let's counter offer him $4 million. And then they decided that they could build their own site in the UK for less than $4 million. So they did.
Would you have sold it for four?
I don't know.
Oh, you must have. I mean, my word, you'd have sold
know.
It for four, wouldn't you?
I don't know. Well, then what would I do?
Well, retire.
$4 million's not very much money to retire on.
Oh, it is where I'm from. Crikey. £4 million. Feet up for the rest of your life.
When I was...
Move to India.
When I was in my 30s, I worked in finance, I remember My net worth was £1 million.
Wow.
Bow, you know. And I called up this old girlfriend of mine. I said, did it? I'm worth £1 million. And she'd married off. And she said, £1 million? I mean, you've got to get the kids through school. What can you get in London for £1 million? And all of a sudden, by the end of the conversation, I felt like, she's right, isn't she? £1 million isn't going to get you very far. Honestly, you know, you'll see when you have kids in school fees. £4 million won't get you very far.
If I have kids, I'll send them to a state school. I'm still a snivelling old lefty at heart, I'm afraid. £4 million. You'd have considered it for four, though, wouldn't you?
That I would be very tempted, but, I mean, I kind of feel I've got another... I was 50 last year. I'll probably do this in another 10 years because I can't think of anything better to do. And by that time, would it have been around 25 years?
And have you ever considered, and I kind of know what the answer's going to be, but have you ever considered standing for Parliament?
No.
Not at any point, not even in the throes of youth when you were exuberant about politics?
I don't think I did. I mean, I did used to joke with that I wanted I wanted the same Irish baronetcy that Osborne's got. You know, if I'm going to get a gong, if I ever get the negatives, the right negatives, then I'm going to want an Irish baronetcy because the wife says that she's not going to accept for anything less. So,
do you think they ever would? Can you ever imagine a politician in the future ennobling Paul Staines?
No, I can't. I can't. When Toby Young, who I've known for 20 years, had his little problem just recently, after it all settled down, I called him and said, I'm thinking of applying for this job at the Office of Students. He goes, please do, because after about a week, I'll then be the second most reviled man in Britain. I'm not fit for public office, am I? Let's be honest, you know. If I was public office, I'd have to take myself down, you know.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, do you worry about your reputation?
I know my oldest daughter's just turning 12, 13, and we live in Ireland, and I know that she, at some point, is going to Google Daddy's name.
And she probably would have done, wouldn't she?
My Wikipedia entry is written by my enemies. You know, it's kind of bonkers. And I think it'll be... I think it will I'll have a lot of explaining to do. I've already explained to them that people on Twitter are horrible and that not everything everybody says is true. And my kids read The Week Junior. Do you know that magazine? It's great.
The Week. I didn't know there was a junior
version. There's a junior version of The Week. In fact, it's pretty handy if you've missed out on the news. I just have a quick look through it, catch up on last week. Oh, Boris Johnson's foreign secretary? You know? And they have a sort of vanilla interest in current affairs. And they hate Donald Trump. And they always double check. And they, Daddy, did you vote for Donald Trump? No, I didn't vote for Donald Trump.
Did you get a vote?
No.
I was going to say.
I'm not going to lie to the kids, am I? And they, I remember when they knew I was backing Boris for mayor, my oldest daughter got obsessed with Boris becoming King of London. And I said, do you want to meet him? And she's like, no. And it was kind of Nicoletting fear of actually meeting Boris.
Well, that raises...
I am very concerned that they understand that Daddy's not a baddie. Yes.
If, I mean, there are certain things on your Wikipedia page that would concern children reading them. How would you... if your children do ask you uncomfortable questions about things you've done, how would you explain it?
To my wife's distress, I always tell them the truth, which she's like, you didn't have to say that. Well, you know, so what? I mean, I'm not sure what you're worried about on the Wikipedia page. I assume it would be drug taking. Well, I hope it's going to put them off. If Daddy's done it, it must be naff, right? So.
I wonder with this week junior, whether the week junior, whether there's an option for Guido there. Is there a kind of junior Guido site you could set up? Is there an app?
When I saw that Rush Limbaugh had written a children's Christmas book and it was top of the New York bestsellers list, I thought, my God, I could redo all the classic fairy tales with a kind of conservative moral twist, couldn't I? I mean, this is it. And I did seriously contemplate this after a few drinks. So, but then I realised, actually, all the fairy tales are already conservative moral tales, aren't they? So I can't really put my own twist on them. And I'd have to go down the David Williams route of making up stories.
You could cynically do left-wing versions just to make money.
I could do, I suppose. Is that really... I find that hard. I'm not... You know, barristers are supposed to have that ability to make any argument. I'm not sure I could.
Well, Paul, it has been... I mean, I could spend another 100 hours with you discussing the site and your career and your services to politics. I mean, do you feel in a way that you've done British politics a service?
I think we've knocked out quite a few bad people. We've ended the careers of people who shouldn't have been in politics. We've exposed a lot of skullduggery and wrongdoing. And we've had a bit of fun on the way. You know, that's not been a bad achievement.
Is it mostly for you about enjoying it and having fun with it rather than exposing wrongdoing?
I wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't fun, but I do enjoy exposing wrongdoing, if you see what I mean. I could do much more boring things and much more lucrative. This is more fun. And I get invited to lots of places to meet interesting people and have a seat at the first drafting of history, don't you?
Well, it's a great website. I mean, whatever people's issues with it, it is one of a kind, and there's no other website like it. I mean, do you fear rivals?
I see them come and go, but there's plenty of... for instance, on the right, obviously, there's sort of a spectrum, isn't there? There's Spectator Coffee House, which is respectable and worthy and it has a sense of humour, you know, of kind. Then there's someone like Westminster, which is kind of UKIP-y and speaks like that, you know. And then there's Breitbart, which is, if we're the sun, then they're the express, you know. so there's a... I don't think the cake... there's a big cake there, so it doesn't detract from us. I think we've got pretty much a lock on that Westminster soap opera gossip, and that's why I don't want to get away from that. That's where I want to stay, because what I realised is it's addictive, and because it's updated 10 times a day, and you get your tweet and the buzz and the phone, and you see it and it says exclusive, you click, don't you? I know you click because I've watched you read our emails because you're a subscriber and you open about a third of our emails and you like anti-Corbyn stories.
Wow.
I checked before I came, so I can see what you're reading.
That's scary.
It's not scary. It's just data, isn't it?
I think they're the things I'm just more likely to read.
Yeah, but I mean, I also know what all BBC journalists read because they all... subscribe to... I shouldn't tell this now. They'll change their email address.
Well, that's fascinating. Paul, thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
Paul Staines, a.k.a. Guido Fawkes. What a brilliant guest. It was one of those ones where, on the way back home, I kept thinking of questions I should have asked. So I hope I covered most of the things that you'd have wanted me to have asked there. I think I got one of my big questions out there. And he gave us a scoop as well. Steve Bannon, Trump's one-time head of strategy, wanted to buy the site for £4 million. I mean, I would sell most things for £4 million. I don't think I've got anything worth that, so maybe that's the difference between Paul and I. But it was great. Just a really straight, frank interview in every regard. An insight into why he does it, into the problems it causes personally for him and the risks associated with doing it. But you get with him as you get with, I think, all people who are attracted to politics, whether it's as an advisor, as a politician, as a journalist, as a blogger, if you would make that distinction between journalism and what Paul does. It's obviously I count it as political journalism, but there is that attraction to it. There is that something else. It's not just about the money. And of course, for most politicians, it's not. And for most people in politics, it's not. But there is something else about it. There is an addiction that politics creates that you just can't shake. And I include myself in that. There is just something about it that is endlessly fascinating in every regard. The ideas, the way it changes, the individuals, and hopefully, I don't want to start any addictions, But hopefully through this podcast, you get an insight into why so many different people join it in so many different ways and get so many different things out of it. Thank you for all your wonderful emails. Keep emailing me, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @MattFord, and follow Paul Staines, Guido, @GuidoForks. I should also say, I'm out on tour again in a couple of months, so do come and see me live. I'm at the Glasgow Stand on the 25th of March, I think that's a Sunday, and then at the Edinburgh Stand on the 27th of March, which is a Tuesday, and after that, on to Bristol, a week at the Soho Theatre in London, Banbury, Harpenden, Sale, Tiverton, Loughborough, Cheltenham, all the big places, Chippenham, Stockton, and of course, the live political party shows. You can get tickets for all those shows on the website, mattford.com/live. Also, and I know I'm saying this every week now, but if you could leave a review on iTunes, it really does help. We have a lot of people who listen to the show, but if you could leave a review, it only takes a couple of seconds. If you could leave a review on iTunes, it does help other people find it and it helps spread the word. If you could as well subscribe to the podcast, and if you could share it widely as possible on social media. If you're not on social media, you tell your mates about it and get them to subscribe, just so that more people can find it. And yes, I just hope you enjoy the shows. It's the highlight of my... It's sad to say the highlight. I've won the highlights of my week, as well as making Unspun, which, by the way, is on every Sunday at 10 o'clock in Dave, the TV show I do. And we've got an extra large version on Wednesday nights as well, which has extra bits from the interview and extra jokes. But that and this are just wonderful things to make. Just as someone who's obsessed by politics, and not necessarily in the ideological sense, just by the whole thing, it's great to be able to sit opposite people who've played such big parts in it and different roles in it, and pick their brains. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you for downloading it. Spread the word, and I'll see you next week. Cheers. Bye.